You're listening to the Cultural Hall Podcast with your hosts, Richie T. Stedman and Lauren Johnson. It's a podcast about Mormon stuff.
Nephi! Emma! Samuel! Do you slant it to live righteously?
Hey, it's me, Richie T, here, wishing you a very Merry Christmas. Again, encourage you to go online, follow us at theculturalhall.com, or go to Facebook and, like us, The Cultural Hall, or go to Twitter, at The Cultural Hall, and that's how you'll be able to keep in touch with us. Hope you're having a very Merry Christmas, and you're making great New Year's resolutions and stuff like that. I want to share these quick sponsors with you of this podcast, and then our interview with Jim Gaffigan in The Cultural Hall. Again, Merry Christmas.
Sidewinder Media was named as one of Utah's top photographers by In This Week magazine and is a winner of several awards for fine art, portrait, and event photography. Sidewinder Media has been professionally photographing everything from wildlife to headshots for over 10 years. Sidewinder Media has the experience and the knowledge to capture your special occasion or portrait the way you want it. They also film and edit music or product videos and do simple ads for Facebook or websites. Email them at sidewindermedia@gmail.com or call Rusty at 801-941-5576 to book your shoot today.
This podcast is brought to you by Sponsor Me Slim, your New Year's resolution solution. Lose weight 5 times faster with easy, nutritious meals and a successful weight loss coach. Meet with Denny Hill from The Biggest Loser. Call today for your free assessment, 801-652-7538. Be sure to ask about our holiday specials.
All right, it's time for another episode of The Cultural Hall, and Merry Christmas to all of us, but especially to me. This, I feel like, is an early Christmas gift. Joining me on the phone is Jim Gaffigan. That's right, the comedian Jim Gaffigan. And where are you at right now, Jim?
I am from New York City. I'm calling you from New York City, downtown, in my two-bedroom apartment.
It's 1 in the morning there, then, am I right?
It is 1 in the morning on a Friday, which is probably the more exhausting days of the week. So if I sound tired, please excuse me.
Oh, you're fine. Did you have a show tonight?
I did have a show. I did a show at a comedy club here in New York. In preparation, I'm doing some theater shows tomorrow in New Jersey. So you got to get the muscle going, I guess.
How
I'll describe it.
You got to warm it up in New York for the Jersey folk.
Well, these theater shows are pretty serious. You know, I don't want anyone leaving one of my shows where people have paid $30 or more thinking, it was all right. I want them to leave saying, that was great. I want to come back next time he's in town,
Yeah, definitely. Now, if people don't know, and I can't imagine that there is anyone that doesn't, but for the sake of introduction, I kind of jumped into it thinking, everyone knows who Jim Gaffigan is. I'll read the bio that I found from you on kingsburyhall.org. And the reason why that website is important is Jim's coming here to Salt Lake City on the 13th and the 14th of January, and he's doing one of those theater shows, two theater shows here. So pulled it up. And it says, Gaffigan has proven himself a major talent, beloved to a wide range of audiences, achieving accolades and awards for his stand-up comedy, acting, and writing. His clever, quiet style has made him one of the top 5 most successful touring comedians in the country, and his CDs and DVDs have reached platinum sales. So based on that, I wanted to ask you, who are the other 4?
Well, the other 4 are a shifting kind of pool of who's hot now.
Because I'll help you take them out, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, I've never, to be perfectly honest with you, I've never aspired to be number one. I mean, that's something that was prepared by my manager, obviously. But, I'm a comedian who... I write everything with my wife and, I enjoy the process of stand-up. I love performing, but, my life goal is not to take over the world. I think of myself as like one of the few comedians that doesn't want to be a rock star. I think that's kind of a bio that you know, they prepare for the morning DJ who's running a zoo show.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So that if they don't know who I am, I might crack through some of the perception game.
He's one of the top five. Don't you get it? One of the top five.
Right. You know, it's, you know, I always think that, you know, my show is one of those where, you know, it's the type of show where you could bring your 15-year-old kid and not be embarrassed. So, you know, I feel like I have an advantage. You know, there's two groups of audience that can go, you know.
Uh-huh. How did you get into comedy? Did you, is it something you always wanted to do? Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I'm the youngest of six kids, so I, not that I suppose that has that much to do with it, but I grew up in a rather funny family in Indiana, and, you know, I grew up in a small town. I didn't really imagine that anyone would go into stand-up comedy. I mean, this is, you know, we're talking 100 years ago. But it's something that I watched on television. You know, I watched The Tonight Show, and I would see these comedians, and I thought that would be really cool, but, you know, growing up in a small town in Indiana that was the only real form of entertainment was the marching band, I didn't really see it as a realistic opportunity. But, I studied finance, and I did an improv class when I got out of college out of a fear of, you know, public speaking, and it's something I always wanted to do, but I just didn't really think that I had the guts to kind of follow through on it.
And then what was the what was the tipping point? So that this improv class, was that in Indiana?
No, it was in New York City.
Okay.
I mean, in full disclosure, I was the kid in this small town in Indiana that kind of looked around when he was a teenager and thought there's been this enormous mistake. But so I got to New York City. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew that I wanted to live in this kind of hustle, bustle, and crazy world. And I was taking an improv class, and someone dared me to do it.
Was that
I
it?
Always secret.
That probably
yeah,
wasn't UCB.
I secretly wanted to do it, so I was kind of waiting for someone to kind of give me the okay to. I had the excuse to try it. I mean, this is before Comedy Central and satellite radio and, you know, Netflix and all this stuff. So,
and so you tried it, and then once you'd given yourself the excuse, you just fell in love and went with it, or what happened?
Yeah, I mean, it was incredibly empowering, you know, to go up, you know, on stage and, you know, say these funny things. I was kind of a class clown in school, but you know, within my family, I was kind of, the joke in my family was that I was considered third funniest. But,
after a brother and then like your dad or something like that, like, oh, Jim, he's third funniest.
Yeah, well, no, actually, behind two brothers. But, you know, that's some of the big family chaos that maybe, you know, in Utah people would understand, but outside of there, it might be, you know, a couple Irish Catholic families in St. Louis and Boston would kind of get, but
so is that your family background, Irish Catholic?
Yes.
How was that, pretty strict growing up then?
It was, you know, yeah, I would say it was pretty strict. It was definitely, you know, kind of a yesteryear version of conservative. You know, it wasn't kind of the, you know, the political version of conservative. I was raised conservatively where, you know, you would seek security. So pursuing some odd dream like stand-up comedy was really considered odd and unusual behavior. So
yeah, that's not
me announcing.
Yeah, kind of
me announcing I wanted to be a comedian. You know, I might as well announce that I wanted to be an astronaut that would go to Mars, you know, to my family.
But they supported you through it.
Well, they supported, you know, I was definitely the crazy sibling, you know, for many years, but, you know, there was definitely, you know, I was raised in a family that was, supportive in a lot of ways, but, you know, it was definitely not an artistic family. You know, it's just, it was just unaware to them. So it was just seemed rather odd. You know, my father was a banker, and, you know, a lot of my brothers are bankers, and my sister was a banker. So,
well, that's what you do, Jim. You get a job as a banker. You wear a suit, you wear a shirt, and you wear a tie, and you go 9 to 5, and you read the paper, and then you come home with a briefcase.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it was definitely, you know, you work, you know, your butt off for, you know, 30, 40 years, and then maybe you retire and you get a boat, or you, you know, play golf for 5 years, and then you die. That was kind of the model that I was raised in. And, I don't know. I mean, I'm a very lucky man. You know, I never really think that, I never thought that I would be in this position. There were many times, you know, 10 years ago, where I thought that I would be the eccentric uncle to all my nephews and nieces that lived in New York, that tried to be funny on, you know, at night in these comedy clubs in New York. And, you know, because what I was doing, you know, was clean comedy and observational stuff when people around me were, like, simulating having sex with chairs. So it's like what I was doing was rather odd. I don't mean, you know, I'm not intending to sound like I'm patting myself on the back.
No.
That's not my point. But the odds were not kind of in my favor. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh. How come? Let's go right to it. A question that I know a lot of people will have is about working clean, you know, being a clean comedian. Have you always been a clean comedian? And was it a conscious choice to be clean, or did you just kind of fall into it?
Well, I think that, you know, I've been doing stand-up over 20 years now, right? And I would say that the great irony is that I ended up doing what I always wanted to do, which was kind of my sensibility. That's not to say that I don't curse occasionally in everyday life, but in my show, it's, you know, I'm talking about rather mundane topics, whether it be, you know, a Subway restaurant shop or, you know, seafood. So it's not necessary to curse or working out or being the father of four. It's not necessary to curse. But, I guess in a way it was a conscious decision, just because I was doing these Letterman and Conan sets. And I was finding that I had to edit out some curse words, but there wasn't an enormous amount of them. You know, when you talk about mundane topics such as bacon or manatees, you don't really have to curse about them.
Even though sometimes you really want to. I mean, you know, being honest.
You know, I don't know. I mean, do I occasionally want to, but I feel, though, you know, it's not the most creative way.
No.
You know, I'm not, you know, this is not a puritanical belief. And, you know, growing up in Indiana, there's a lot of people that have my kind of point of view on that. You know, I was shocked when I moved to New York to work in advertising how often people would curse. And, again, it's a cultural thing. It's not to say that, you know, people don't, you know, in different Latin American countries, there's, you know, there's countries that curse and there's countries that don't. And, you know, being from the Midwest, it's, you know, you might curse if you stub your toe, but if you're trying to make someone laugh, it might, you know, any comedian would tell you that's the easiest way to, you know, that's called a shock laugh. But
sure.
I don't know. I guess, you know, having done it so long, I went through different versions where I was high energy, where I was kind of irreverent, where I, you know, would throw in these cuss words. But, you know, after like 7 years, I kind of settled into my own style. And then, you know, I made a conscious decision. If you're going to talk about some of the minutiae of the world, you know, and you're going to do a, you know, when I was headlining in clubs 45 minutes and then in the theater an hour and 15 minutes, you can't be dirty and then after that talk about email. It just doesn't work, you know.
Yeah, so, once you've kind of broken the seal on it, it kind of, you have to just keep going, I would guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's the weird thing is stand-up has such a strong tradition of combating censorship, but, you know, I don't think that we live in a day where people aren't free to express their views. You know, I think there's a lot of value in comedians that are social satirists and comedians that are challenging the status quo. But that's not who I am. That's not my spirit. You know, my comedy is inspired, constructed around who I am, which is this guy who struggles with laziness and struggles with, you know, kind of the seven deadly sins of, you know, gluttony and all this stuff, which, you know, to my luck, happens to be something that a lot of people struggle with. So, you know, to like some 17-year-old kid that wants to just hear someone curse or say, you know, dirty words, it's not going to be appealing, but there's plenty of 17-year-olds that are intelligent enough that know that, you know, just crass language is just crass language. And that's not to say that some of my favorite comics don't curse, but, you know, I just have to kind of do what I do. You know, I always kind of feel that comedians either get too much credit or too much criticism for what they do, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know, giving me credit or criticism for being clean or family friendly is just like, it's either funny or not, you know. And so, you know, whether Chris Rock is funny or not, it doesn't matter if he curses, or it doesn't matter if Lewis Black curses or not. It's either makes you laugh or it doesn't. It either gets you out on a January night to go to a comedy club or a theater or not. So,
well, let me ask you this. When you come and play Utah, my assumption, and maybe I'm completely wrong, you know, a lot of Mormons in Utah.
Yeah.
Is it a different feeling performing, assumedly, for a room full of Mormons?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I'm kind of a Mormon lover. And, you know, that sounds kind of pandering, but, you know, there's something, you know, I did this thing with my wife and Paul Notes, who's a cartoonist for New York, the New Yorker, called Pale Force. And some of it is, you know, I don't know, I feel kind of a strange brethren with the Mormons in that, you know, obviously I have respect for anyone that has faith or even an atheist, you know. Mm-hmm. People that have a principle that they follow is perfectly fine to me. But I remember I did a show in, I want to say Sandy. Is there a Sandy, Utah?
Uh-huh.
And I did a show. It was an outdoor theater.
Yeah, the Sandy Amphitheater. That would make sense.
Yeah. And I did a show there, and I you know, did a meet and greet afterwards where everyone that came to the show, and you know, I'm a pale guy who's from a big family, and when I was signing, you know, posters and CDs after the show, it was kind of staggering to me how many pale people there are. You know, that's not to say that there aren't, you know, every, you know, it's kind of a strange thing, you know, if you're a pale person, you kind of get this. It's like, you know, the racism that, you know, African-Americans or anti-Semitism that Jewish people have dealt with is really serious. But when you're a pale person, there's a certain kind of like, ostracized nature that you have to kind of deal with, which is more of a nuisance compared to like racism or anything like that. But so there's, you know, there was just a lot of pale people when I did that show in Sandy. And after that, I came back and I wrote with my wife and, you know, these people that I did Pale Force with, which happened to be my wife's siblings. And, you know, we did this Pale Force thing about Utah being really pale and having a competition with Maine being very pale, because I had done a show in Maine within the past year. And so there's something about Utah, and, you know, it's like I'm a person of faith, so it's like I don't have any, you know, it's kind of like a, there's, it kind of fits in the pocket, you know, where I respect people of faith. You know, I happen to be a clean comedian, and that's not to say that I'm crystal clean. I don't want to, you know, mislead anyone.
Sure.
You know, but it is the type of show where you could bring your 15-year-old son and not be embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not by design. It's just kind of by, you know, consequence of how I do my act. It's just a benefit.
Have you ever
known? Where when I've done shows in Utah, I'm kind of like, yeah, these are kind of my people. And when I do Twitter and stuff like that, if I can smell, if I could spell Mormon right, it would probably work better. But I don't know. It's just one of those things where it feels familiar to me. You know, I'm a Midwesterner, I'm an Irish Catholic, but I don't know. It makes sense. I don't know.
Have you ever known any Mormon people, or learned about the Mormon faith, or, you know, anything as far as that goes?
Yeah, I mean, I know a fair amount. I know, you know, some of the history, you know, being in Illinois, and, you know, the path across, and, you know, I know that, you know, when I, you know, I went to college in D.C., and I, you know, I was in Jerusalem, and I met some Mormons there. But we're talking in generalizations.
Sure.
Which, you know, can work as a positive or a negative, but, you know, I'm a comedian who lives in New York City, who, you know, is from a small town in Indiana, who happens to be Catholic. So, I constantly encounter, you know, friends and peers kind of describing these flyover red states in a very dismissive, you know, all-encompassing way, which I find kind of annoying and kind of, you know, dismissive. And so, but to answer your question, obviously I've known, you know, I'm 44 years old, you know, it's like I've known tons of Mormons in my life, but, and, you know, there's, you know, I know a handful of comedians that happen to be Mormon, but, you know, I'll never be as big as Brian Regan in Utah, but, you know, it's, there is a connection, I think, you know.
Yeah, I think you can count on, you have these two shows, the January the 13th Friday and then Saturday January the 14th. I'm sure that you can count on those shows being sold out, just because people here appreciate and love you. Not only, like you mentioned, because you know, it's clean, but you're something that it can be a whole family thing, and you know, I think you spoke about the values and some of those things, and I think that shines through to that. I was following you on your Twitter the other day, and when you tweeted about that you're performing here in Salt Lake City and that you're bringing your wife and your four kids with you, how is that? Comedians not normally. How long have you been married for?
We're going on, I'd say, 8 years.
Okay.
Is it 8 years, Jeannie?
Yes, 8 years.
8 years.
and you've got four kids. That is uncommon as well. Is that based from your own kind of family upbringing that you want to have that family? Or how do you balance family and being, you know, one of the top five most successful touring comedians?
Well, you know, I got to be honest. I'm somebody that I didn't expect to have this life. I thought that, like, the gift that I was given was that I was going to actually discover something that I enjoyed to do, you know? So, you know, to be married to a beautiful woman and have these children, I mean, I'm a rather, I think children are like this cure for narcissism. You know, it's like, I didn't get to have dinner with my children tonight, and it kind of eats at me. You know, it's kind of like I feel like I've lost my way with my priorities within the past 12 hours. But, you know, it's funny because that, you know, there's also that thing. You know, it's like I do think that, like, I'm one of six in my family, and my wife's the eldest of nine.
Oh, so, my gosh. And is she Catholic as well?
Yes, she's Irish Catholic. And it's, so there's that big family mentality, which is, yeah. And by the way, you don't have to be from a big family. It's you know, there's a certain kind of a mentality, right? Which is kind of which I feel like I'm lucky to be in. You know, it's like I'm in this this field where a lot of my friends are, you know, great guys, great women that are caught up in career. And, you know, I've many times found myself kind of caught up in career and lost in, you know, really kind of the wrong priorities. But, you know, here I am where, you know, we're kind of, you know, I mean, we have four kids, but, you know, if my wife turned around tomorrow and said she was pregnant, you know, it would be only a positive thing. You know, it's, I also have like, you know, 15 minutes on being the father of four kids, but and just how, like, you know, as we go into these, you know, the 2000 years, it's like having a kid is, it's an incredible sacrifice, but having four, you know, people treat you like you're a little bit insane. You know, we're put kind of in the same category as the octomom, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, there's the octomom, and then there's just like people that are having, you know, it's very strange that society would kind of cast this, you know, this bias on people that have too many kids. You know, like, well, Brad and Angelina, they can have adopt all these kids because they make $30 million a movie. But it's not, you know, raising a large family is not about money. It's about kind of, you know, your commitment to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
and
it's a strange thing.
You know, I, as a new parent, I only have one kid, and I stepped in when he was 12. And I can't even imagine more than one. You know, I'm doing 7 hours of homework every night, and I do theater here. I do musical theater locally, so that's why I wasn't able to talk to you until now. I was doing a couple shows, and it's like, hey, kid, I'm sorry. I'll get you up in the middle of the night, and we'll do that. I can't even imagine more than one, and then, you know, to have four. I know I've only got you for, a couple minutes. I want to ask you, we ask everyone that comes on the podcast with us two questions. One, I'll kind of clue you in. I'll teach you a little Mormon phrase, and then and then you can talk about that. But first is, and you can interpret this however you want, I want to know what your favorite thing about your faith is.
Favorite thing about my faith?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it has to be mercy for me. It's that, you know, I'm the beneficiary of mercy, so... You know, my faith is constructed around mercy. It's one of those things where, you know, the ability to, you know, that there is someone or something that has forgiveness behind it, and that I'm not in control and I'm not the punisher of myself is incredibly empowering. So that's kind of a cornerstone of how I can kind of live with myself, to be honest. So I would say that's the most important thing. You know, and when I'm not in touch with, you know, which I think is a pretty important element of mercy, which is humility. You know, I'm pretty lost. You know, it's, and that's not to say that, you know, I mean, I am, you know, not perfect, obviously, but it's, you know, it, this is, you know, we're on a roller coaster here, but when I kind of come back down to ground, I'm very much, I can hold on to that and keep a touch of that. It's a lot easier for me, you know.
Yeah. So here's the other thing. So let me give you a short history lesson. Inside the Book of Mormon, there's a group of people who built like a tower of Babel. They call it the Ramiumptum, and people would get up on this thing, and they would pray for everyone around them to see and hear them, like, oh, how great are they, right? So as part of this podcast, we've kind of adopted it where people, when they want to tell everyone about what they've got going on, what's coming up for them in the future, kind of you know, in regular business, you might say to pimp yourself as to what's going on. We ask people to climb up on the Ramiumptum and say a little bit about what you got going on. I'll start it with Friday, January 13th and Saturday, January 14th at 8 p.m. You can see Jim Gaffigan at Kingsbury Hall. You can go to kingsburyhall.org or go to theculturalhall.com. We'll link it with this episode of The Cultural Hall so you can buy tickets to see him. He's very funny. But what else have you got going on? Climb on up.
Well, I would say that I would just add to it that it's a new hour and that I would be doing some classics that people might see on YouTube. So
Is Hot Pocket your most famous, would you say? Is that what?
I would say that or Bacon or Manatee. But, yeah, you know, it's definitely, you know, it's such a blessing that it ends up kind of being maybe an annoyance, you know, walking home from a show tonight, you know. I don't know if I need some drunk guy yelling Hot Pocket at me, but, you know, there's worse things, right?
Yeah.
But, I don't know. I mean, I would say that I'm a very lucky man, you know, so it's like, I mean, you know, I appreciate you letting me do this, and, you know, I'm, you know, I have this new hour that I've written with my wife, and maybe I would encourage people to follow me on Twitter or my wife at Jeannie Gaffigan at Twitter. But, you know, it's great. You know, I'm excited that I'm in the position that I can go out and do these shows and then take my kids skiing. You know, it's, you know, that's a pretty good life, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, so other than that, I'm good.
Let me ask you this. I was going to let you go, but it's come up a couple of times, and I just want to ask you. You write everything with your wife?
Yes.
How is that dynamic?
Well, it's a very interesting dynamic. It's you know, she's a very brilliant woman who is very funny in her own way, and over the course of our relationship, we have I've kind of brainwashed her to my sensibility. She has her own sensibility, but so when we write together, she can kind of write jokes or tags or ideas. You know, we're writing a pilot for NBC together that, you know, where it kind of works in conjunction, where, you know, I feel like there's been some healthy dose of brainwashing where she understands my sensibility, so I have a secret weapon. But it's also great, you know, stand-up's a very solitary kind of endeavor, and having someone else contribute to that is dangerous, but if it's your wife, you know, the motives are very pure, and I love it. You know, it you know, it sounds like, oh my gosh, would they be fighting all the time? But when we're writing stand up, it's like we're only really laughing. You know,
Doing something you love with someone you love—that's awesome. I appreciate your time so much. I'm looking forward again. There will be a link at theculturalhall.com, or you can just find it Kingsbury Hall.org. And it's the 13th and 14th of January, both 8 p.m. Tickets begin at, looks like, $38 and then go up from there.
Wow.
You can get also at kingtix.com. Jim, thank you very much for being a part of the Cultural Hall, and I look forward to hopefully getting the chance to meet you in person when you come to town.
Surely, you got it.